And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll spend most of the hour with film historian and Orson Welles expert Joseph McBride, the first of a number of interviews which we're going to be presenting about Orson Welles as Kenosha gears up to celebrate his 100th birthday, which would have been this Wednesday, the 6th of May. We'll also be talking about Orson Welles on Monday and Wednesday of next week. In part two of today's program, towards the end of the hour, we're going to recap for you five different exciting fine arts events which are going on this weekend. Libana tonight at Prairie School. Man of La Mancha at Carthage tonight and tomorrow. Performances of the Putnam County Spelling Bee at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Opera singer Angela Brown in both Racine and Kenosha Saturday and Sunday. And on Sunday afternoon, the great music of Benny Goodman at Fine Arts at First. So we'll remind you about all of that at the end of today's Friday morning show here on WGTD. The city of Kenosha is bracing for what promises to be a spectacular celebration of one of its most famous local sons, namely the legendary filmmaker Orson Welles. He was born 100 years ago on the 6th of May, and the centennial of his birth is being celebrated in a splendid fashion with a whole host of exciting events which have been planned. And through the course of the next few days, we're going to be telling you a lot about more about them and helping spread the word about this important event in the history of Kenosha. I'm very happy to kick off WGTD's own coverage of this event by speaking for the next few minutes with somebody who knew Orson Welles, who worked with him, and who has written extensively about him. Film historian Joseph McBride. He is the author of a number of important books, including biographies of other important figures in film, like Frank Capra, Steven Spielberg, John Ford. Most recently, the author of a much-discussed book about the Kennedy assassination called Into the Nightmare. Among several different books which he has written about Orson Welles is one titled Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, which in particular focuses on the last decades of Orson Welles' life, which are very much misunderstood. And much of the important groundbreaking work which he did in that period remains, for the most part, unknown, especially to the American public, including his final film, The Other Side of the Wind, which was never completed, but was evidently a project very near and dear to Orson Welles' heart. And that was a film in which Joseph McBride actually appeared. And it was during the making of that film that he had the opportunity to speak with Orson Welles extensively and get to know in a very personal way this filmmaker whom he had long idolized. So it's very, very exciting for me now to have this opportunity. Joseph McBride, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, Greg, thank you for having me. It's great to talk to the people of Kenosha about Welles, native son, and I'm from Wisconsin as well, and that was part of my initial interest in Welles, that he was a Wisconsin boy made good, you know?
Very good. Ahead of us talking about Orson Welles, and I don't want us to spend too much time doing this, but I wonder if you could just say a quick word about your own intense fascination with film. Can you trace the beginning of that? I mean, do you recall at what point movies became more than just mere entertainment to you?
Well, I was, my father, Ray McBride, was a TV, radio, and film critic for the Milwaukee Journal. And so I was kind of a film buff from the word go, and I used to see a lot of films downtown and in the theaters and on television. But when I got to Madison to go to the University of Wisconsin in 1965, I became a real film buff. And the impetus for that was Citizen Kane. I saw it in 1966, and I was 19 years old, and Welles' first Hollywood feature film, it just totally knocked me out. I was planning to become a novelist and a journalist. I've been a journalist my whole life, but Kane reoriented me and made me realize that I should, write films and write about films and study films. So I started doing a book on Wells because I went out to see if I could get a good book to read, and there was nothing in English that I thought was any good. So I, this is the impetus for a lot of books. You just figure, well, I better write this book because I want to read it.
Because it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Early in this book that we will primarily talk about, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, you pose a really interesting question, namely, how did the world view Orson Welles at the time that he returned to America from what had been a fairly lengthy exile of sorts? And one of the things that struck me, that's why I want to ask this question right off the bat, is that when you're asking about, how the typical American viewed Orson Welles in 1970, we realize 1970 was years before such a thing as VCRs. So for somebody, the typical American, what kind of exposure would they have even had to even the important films of Orson Welles from earlier in his career? It's not like you could go to Netflix or go to your local video store or have a million cable channels to choose from to try to see some of these films. How was it that that Orson Welles was anything more than a name in a book?
He was kind of forgotten in a sense. I mean, on television, if you wanted to see Citizen Kane or some of the films that he acted in, they occasionally popped up, but he wasn't taken as seriously as he is now. And for me, as a film maven back then, I was frustrated that he was a mystery man. He was in Europe, and you'd hardly read anything about him. You'd read little items in Variety. That's how I'd find out what he was doing. There'd be some item that he was shooting a film in Rome or something. But there wasn't much interest in him in the media in America. He'd been gone since 1947, pretty much. He came back occasionally to make a film here and there, but he mostly was in Europe, and he was really blacklisted. He was a progressive, not a communist, but a liberal, and so the FBI and the Red Hunters, were after him, and he fled to Europe, also partly because his career as a filmmaker was in disarray in the late 40s, and so he was a European filmmaker for a long time, and he became more and more independent. Then he came back to America in 1970, which I was very lucky. I went to Hollywood for the first time in 1970 to interview John Ford, who's my really favorite filmmaker, and I was writing a book about him. I was finishing the Welles book, and through a series of happy chances, I found out that Welles was in Hollywood, and he wanted to meet me. And so I got to meet him, and he was about to start shooting a film. He had just come back to the States and was relocating. I think he felt that the new Hollywood, which we now call the Easy Rider era, when the young filmmakers were kind of taking over from the old system, which was in collapse, everything was changing. He thought it might be a good opportunity for him to make low-budget films and, independent artistic kind of films that the system seemed to, the new order of things seemed to show that could be done. But he was frustrated that there was no place for him in the studios. Even then, they were interested in the young guys, and an older filmmaker like him with a track record and with all the baggage that he had of the myth that he was unreliable and uncommercial, et cetera, really made it impossible for him to work in the studios. And he was very bitter and very burned by his experiences in the studios. It's amazing that he kept going as much as he did. But he was shooting independently for the last 15 years of his life. And that's one reason I wrote this latest book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, because people don't know much about that period, as you said, that they thought he was just doing those wine commercials and doing an occasional cameo role in films or television, but he was shooting his own independent films almost every day. And he kept shooting 9 years after he stopped shooting The Other Side of the Wind, which is still in the works. They're still trying to finish it. And he had all kinds of projects going on. It was still difficult to get films made. If he were around today with digital cinema, where you can make films for almost nothing, he would be turning out 4 or 5, 6 films a year and getting them on the internet. But, he died right before that kind of thing started to be possible.
Hmm. We're speaking with film historian, film critic Joseph McBride. Joseph McBride knew Orson Welles, actually worked with him, and has written several books about him, including Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career. Although this isn't going to be the primary focus of our conversation, of course, the reason Kenosha, Wisconsin is hosting this extraordinary salute to Orson Welles on the 100th anniversary of his birthday and in the days that follow is because Orson Welles was born right here in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Famously, Orson Welles didn't speak very highly of his hometown and, as far as I know, scarcely ever returned once he left. What can you tell us about his years growing up here in Kenosha? How long was he here? And do we have much of an idea of the source of his unhappy feelings about the city?
Well, it's fairly complicated. I'll try to, you know, make it kind of cut to the chase. Patrick McGilligan, who's a Milwaukee author, good friend of mine, has done a book, or he's finishing a book called Young Orson, which is going to be coming out in August. It's going to have a lot of wonderful details about his parents, who are extraordinary people, and his youth in Kenosha. He lived in Kenosha until pretty much around the time he was 9 or 10. His mother died when he was 9, and then he was sent to Madison to go to school and live with a university instructor, and then he wound up going to a boys' school in Illinois. His father was an industrialist in Kenosha, had a company that made automobile lamps and bicycle lamps. He did quite well for himself. His mother was an extraordinary person, Beatrice Wells. She was a suffragist. She was on the school board, the first woman on the school board in Kenosha. She was a public speaker. She was campaigning for the rights of women, and she put on dramatic events. She was a concert pianist. He got his artistic side from her. And his father was a playboy who loved the theater, and he spent a lot of time in Chicago. So Orson spent a lot of time in Chicago as a kid, both with his mother and father, who had kind of separate lives. The mother knew all the great classical singers and pianists, and he met a lot of those people. And then the father knew a lot of showgirls and playwrights and journalists, and Orson got into that world. And so he had this quite amazing childhood. And he once said it can be an advantage for a child to be from a split family because you get the benefit of two different worlds, you know. But he also had a lot of sadness and grief, and I think that infected his view of Kenosha. When I met him in 1970, I was naturally interested in his Wisconsin roots that we shared. And so I asked him. He had once said that he thought it was too bad that he was born in Kenosha because he was conceived in Rio de Janeiro. He said, I don't know if that's true. And he came out in Kenosha, and he was, but I asked him about it, and he said, I'm not ashamed of being from Wisconsin, just of being from Kenosha. It's a terrible place. And then his companion, Oya Kodar, who was his companion for the last 20-some years of his life, was a Croatian actress and writer. She corrected him. She said, now, Orson, all you remember is the day of your mother's funeral, and it was raining. It was a horrible day. You know. And he said, well, okay, that's true. Well, of course, if that's all you remember, you know, you'd have a bad memory. But that's interesting because he was in Kenosha a lot more than just that one day, but that's all he remembered, apparently. I guess the event was so terrible that it blocked everything out. And in the 30s, he gave an interview to the New Yorker, and he disparaged Kenosha. And the congressman wrote him a letter complaining about this. And Welles wrote probably sort of an insincere letter back about how sorry he was and what a great badger he was and how he loved Kenosha, and he didn't mean to disparage Kenosha. But the truth was he didn't really feel very connected to Kenosha. I mean, he spent, you know, a year in Madison. He told me he liked Madison more. But, you know, he was more of a Chicago kid, I would say. And Chicago, of course, is and was a great metropolitan area with a lot of things that he would be interested in. He said that his Camelot was Woodstock, Illinois, which is a small town where he went to the boarding school, Todd School for Boys. They're doing a tribute to Welles, too. It's a wonderful thing that this year of his centenary, all over the country and in Europe, they're doing tributes to Welles. I'm going to Woodstock right before Kenosha. I'm coming to Kenosha to show the magnificent Ambersons in Wells's neighborhood in one of the old homes, which the neighborhood looks like the Ambersons mansion. You know, that's my favorite film. And, you know, regardless of what he felt about Wisconsin, I think he put a lot of his feelings into Ambersons. It was a film that he loved the most, other than Chimes of Midnight, which is a great Shakespeare film he made later. But Ambersons is a great film in the Midwest, and it's a bittersweet, tragic story about a wealthy family that experiences a tragic fall as the city changes and becomes industrialized. And it expresses his complexity of feelings toward the Midwest. It's a great Midwestern film. And you don't hear much about the Midwest, you know, in terms of milieus, but there are some films that are important, you know, and they're great writers from the Midwest, like Willa Cather and Sinclair Lewis. And Ambersons is written by Booth Tarkington, who's from Indiana. And Wells claimed that his father was the model for the Eugene Morgan character, played by Joseph Cotten, who's an automobile manufacturer. And apparently there could be some truth to that Wells's father did know Tarkington. So Wells felt very personally connected to Ambersons. And the character, the central character, is a young man named George, who's an insufferable, spoiled rich kid who's receives his comeuppance at the end. And Wells's real name was George, and I think he made that kind of a self-portrait, self-criticism. It's an extraordinary film. So he was influenced by his Wisconsin roots, but he was a very cosmopolitan man who was as much European as he was American. That's part of his fascination, I think, for scholars and why he's such an important filmmaker. He's a man of the world, you know, not limited to any region or whatever, but he does have those Wisconsin roots.
To what would you point, if there is something to point to in his early life and upbringing, or maybe in his education, that sort of stamped him as a maverick almost right from the start of his career? I mean, what was it about him that made him so anxious to not fall in line with standard Hollywood practice and to forge his own unique place in the world of film? Where did that spirit of the maverick come from?
That's a great question, and it's you know, it's his lifelong path. And so I think you probably would look back even farther to his days. He was an extraordinary stage director, you know, when he was 20 years old in New York, and he was a star and director of radio, and he did all these extraordinary things at a very early age. And I think that the Todd School had a huge impact on him. He had a great headmaster named Roger Hill, who encouraged the boys to be independent and creative. And it was progressive education before that kind of thing was very common, where the boys would be encouraged to follow their own path. But I think it, you know, you have to look back to his childhood of where his parents treated him like a little adult. And he was an extraordinary child who could speak like an adult. And he said that I once asked him, I thought he had kind of smothering parents. And he said, no, I had the opposite. I had parents who were kind of emotionally distant. But he said that he was only tolerated in the society of his parents' friends if he was entertaining. In other words, he would be sitting with his mother with all her friends, and if he was entertaining, they would listen to him, and he was expected to shine like a little adult. But if he got boring or childish, he would be sent to his room. So he learned very early to be a character, and he had a great speaking voice from childhood, and he put on plays, and he, you know, when he went to Camp Indianola in Madison, he put on plays from day one and did a one-man Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the boys. And he was always doing these individualistic things. He was not a follower. I guess that's probably the simplest explanation. He was a one-man show, as he often said, or one-man band. He could do it all. He was multi-talented, and he didn't like following orders or being regimented. He only went to public school, a couple years in his life, so he didn't have the kind of indoctrination that most people have, you know, with society. He was allowed a lot of indulgence by his parents, even though they were maybe emotionally a little aloof. But it was a one of a kind childhood, and I guess that made him a one of a kind person.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that you became quite intrigued with Orson Welles when you had the opportunity to see Citizen Kane for the first time. Can you just tell us briefly the circumstances under which you got to experience this film for the first time?
Yeah, I was a student at I was an English major in Madison, and we only had two film courses back then. We didn't have a film department or anything, and so I took these two courses, and very quickly, you know, I lost interest in everything else but film, and so I created my own curriculum. I ran the Wisconsin Film Society. I would show films. It was, as you say, it was hard to get films back then because we didn't have tapes and we didn't have Netflix and things like that. So you had to be ingenious to be able to get a hold of films. But we had 35 film societies on campus, and there's a great archive there at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And so I did all this, but it all started with Kane in Richard Burns' film class. I remember it very well in September of 66. It was just like a bolt of lightning. I was very struck by, I think part of it was a newspaper film, and I come from a newspaper family. My parents were newspaper reporters, and I was a newspaper guy from way back. And it's about the media. You know, it's a kind of a far-reaching film that was ahead of its time in dealing with the power of the media, kind of the baleful influence of the media on politics. But formally, the film excited me. The use of the camera and the use of sound was extraordinary, and it called attention to itself in a way that Hollywood films didn't do in those days. They tended to have invisible camera work, but Kane was very flamboyant, and it was, as François Truffaut said, the French critic and filmmaker, that influenced more people to become filmmakers than anybody else, partly because it's a young man's film. It has the spirit of youth and the kind of daring of youth. The fact that he took on William Randolph Hearst was an act of youthful daring and presumption that actually got him in a lot of trouble, but I admired the fact that he did that. And also the use of the medium. He famously said when he walked into a Hollywood studio, "This is the greatest electric train set any boy ever had." Mm-hmm. And you get that sense of playing with the medium in a very excited way. And so all that kind of brought me aware of what films could do. And then I started watching his other films. It just so happened I was fortunate they had a series of about six of his other films on campus. And I realized that Kane was not the only important film he made. Magnificent Ambersons, I saw that fall. Touch of Evil, you know, all these great films. And so I started writing a book about him and getting into his life in detail. And then I was fortunate enough to meet him 4 years later, and he put me in this film, which is kind of a Walter Mitty experience, playing a spoof of myself as a young film critic. I was 23 when I was in The Other Side of the Wind, and I got to help write my own part because it was this film that it was an experimental film that the actors contributed a lot to their characters. So Welles and I would talk for about an hour before every scene, and he would ask me what I would say. I follow John Huston around. I'm supposed to be writing a book about this legendary filmmaker, and I'm sort of a pest and a kind of a naive young guy. And so we exaggerated that for comic effect. And I had wonderful fun. I'd never acted, so it was kind of a bizarre experience for me to be acting for the greatest actors, director in movies. I just was putty in his hands. But, you know, if I had tried to act, he would have. Once in a while, I tried to do something, and he would shout at me, "Don't act, don't act," you know. Mm-hmm. So I was in it for 6 years, which I call that my film school. We didn't, as I say, have a real film school, so that was my film school, because I really learned how films were shot from the inside out, you know.
It is such an odd film on a couple of different levels, and I'll let you describe it to our listeners. And part of what makes it, of course, also a very intriguing film is that there are ways in which, of course, it appears to be profoundly autobiographical, or at least seems to be Orson Welles' very strong statement on what it's like to be an aging filmmaker in a world that doesn't fully appreciate what they're trying to do, what they have worked so hard to achieve. Can you say a word about the sort of personal stamp on this particular film?
Yeah, it's quite clearly that it's like Fellini's Eight and a Half in that regard. It's the story of a old filmmaker, as Welles said to John Huston, "What's this movie about?" And Welles said, "It's about us, John." You know, but Welles often claimed that the film was not autobiographical in the strictest sense, because he made it clear to me when I met him that The character was based on Ernest Hemingway, with whom he had a difficult relationship. He admired Hemingway as an artist, but he also thought he was sort of a blowhard and a sham and all this kind of stuff. And so it was, I was standing on the set with Richard Wilson, who was Welles's oldest associate. And Dick said, Orson, what's this movie about? And Welles said, it's an attack on machoism. Today we'd say machismo, but Welles was making fun of the He-Man, exaggerated He-Man that Hemingway liked to embody. And he was implying that beneath that was a latent homosexuality, which comes out in the course of the film, where the old He-Man director, who's always seduced his leading ladies or the wife of the leading man, now falls in love with the young leading man himself, who walks off the film. And it's Welles' way of kind of satirizing the Hemingway cult. So that's not much like Welles, and also the director is not making the kind of films that Welles made. And it's an odd film because there are two styles going on in the film. There's film, the framework is the last day of this man's life. It's his 70th birthday party. And I and a lot of other people are following him around, and he's being exposed to the public and the media, and he's being kind of devoured by the media as he's trying to make a comeback in Hollywood with all the young people. You know, he's out of place because he's an old reactionary guy, but he's trying to be with it and hip, and he's making this radical chic film. Welles was spoofing Antonioni's Zabriskie Point, which was a film that had just come out that dealt with young radicals, and it was beautiful, but kind of full of people blowing things up and sex and all kinds of stuff. And so that's the film within the film, and that's shot in a different style altogether, neither of which is Welles' own personal style. Although, you know, one thing that Welles did that I liked, but it was hard for him, was that every film he did was different and unexpected. That's one reason he had trouble with his career. He wasn't predictable like some directors are. So here he's making a film that is a spoof of cinema verite, kind of rough, fast cutting, which was way ahead of its time. If it had come out in 1972, let's say, people would have said this is a very revolutionary film. But now with all the fast cutting and rapid camera work, it may not be as unusual, but actually to be easier to follow. Back then, I thought maybe people would have a hard time following this. And then intercut with this is the film within the film. And there's 19 hours of footage in Paris that they still have yet to edit. And 41 minutes was edited by Welles, so we have a sense of what his vision of the film would be like, but there's a lot of work to be done. So the final shape won't be known for a while, but it's quite an extraordinary film. John Huston gives a great, great performance. It's comparable to his performance in Chinatown. And there are a lot of wonderful actors of all kinds, a very eclectic cast ranging from Oscar winners to non-actors like myself and everything in between, and people playing versions of themselves. And it's a tragic comic satirical film. It's a, you know, unusual film, and not everybody's going to love it, but that's what happened when a Welles film would come out. It would split people. Not everybody would get it. Maybe 10 years later, they'd say, well, that's really a classic, you know, like with Touch of Evil or something. And that was true of Stanley Kubrick as well. When his films came out, a lot of people said, what is this, 2001? What's this thing? And then 10 years later, they'd say, this is a great film. So it's, you know, we hope that Other Side of the Wind comes out within the next year or so. Yeah, I was working to finish this film. I took it upon myself to try to raise completion money. And Gary Graver, the cameraman, and I made a deal with Showtime, the cable network, to finish it for $3 million. And we were going to spend a year and a half in post-production. Peter Bogdanovich was going to do the editing. And Oya Kodar, who owns half the film, was involved. And then we made the deal. And as soon as we made the deal, Peter and Oya fired me from the project. They thought I wasn't needed. And then the project collapsed, and then it's been kind of in limbo for the last 16 years. And one thing after another keeps happening to it. But finally, some very good producers from Europe have straightened out a lot of the financial and legal problems. And it's cautiously looking like the film might get finished. There's a very good book about it by Josh Karp called Orson Welles' Last Movie, which just came out. And it's a very entertaining, very insightful account of this kind of bizarre, endless saga. I mean, I've been involved in this for 45 years, so it's it seems like forever. You know, I'm one of the last surviving cast members. A lot of the cast were older people. The crew were all young, like 19-year-old guys, so a lot of the crew are still around. Except Gary Graver, the cameraman, unfortunately died. He really gave his life to the film.
One of the intriguing things you say in your own book about the latter part of Orson Welles' life is that it's maybe possible that because he left so many film projects incomplete in those last several decades, maybe on one level he was sort of declaring his independence, or maybe on whether on a conscious or subconscious level, somehow Orson Welles was making some kind of statement in and of itself just by not finishing some of these projects. Certainly you also contend that it wasn't for laziness or for lack of effort. I mean, he worked desperately hard on certain projects important to him, doing everything he could to bring them to completion. Sadly, in most cases, for naught.
Yeah, those are good observations. I think part of him felt seriously that what he really loved, and one of his actors said, what Orson really loved was just getting up every day and shooting film. And in a sense, he didn't care whether it ever came out or was finished or whatever. That was, he had gotten philosophical. He'd been burned a lot with people taking his films out of his hands and things like that. And then when they came out, they often flopped. And so I think the creative process meant a lot to him on one level. But there was a level on which he really, really wanted The Other Side of the Wind to come out. I mean, he wasn't putting in all this effort for just to keep it in a drawer, you know. And he was frustrated by all the problems he ran into financially and legally. He was a very bad businessman, and he got involved with some unfortunate deals and sometimes, you know, people he shouldn't have been involved with. And he just made a mess of the business side of his career. He needed somebody, a producer, to take care of that side for him. But as a creative artist, he was unparalleled. But he was making other films. He released filming Othello after that. It's a documentary, low-budget documentary about his film Othello. And he was working on a beautiful film called The Dreamers. And we have... I've seen almost all these things. You can now see them sometimes only in archives, or if you go to Europe, they're, for various reasons, some of these films are not widely distributed. They should all be on DVD and streaming video and everything, but you know, you have to go to film festivals and archives to see the 30-minute version of The Dreamers or the 40-minute version of The Other Side of the Wind. Or
one can only hope that this Orson Welles Centennial will maybe cause a few more doors to be unlocked, and maybe some of this Orson Welles material, which is so hard for Americans especially to see, to perhaps finally see the light of day. One can only hope.
Yeah, I think part of it is there are all these, you know, like his estate was very complicated, and there's warring going on between people he left behind, and that's still a problem. You know, there's some complicated personal things and financial things that have inhibited this. So it is frustrating. I think everybody in Wisconsin, Iowa, you know, France, Germany, whatever, should be able to see all these things. But you shouldn't have to go to Munich to see them like I did, or Switzerland, you know. But I think that things with The Other Side of the Wind project has sort of united certain people. Like Welles' daughter Beatrice has been more supportive of these projects than she has before. And there's Zoya Kodar and various people who all, I think, realize that this film, I don't know, has been sitting around for too long. I think it's sort of crazy that a film, you know, a major film about films by one of our greatest directors has not been seen, and it was shot 40-some years ago. Parts of it have been seen in documentaries and all that, but, you know, it's like, one of my selling points when I was trying to get people to put money into this was, you spend $1 million or $2 million to restore some old film, why not spend $3 million and you have a new Orson Welles film?
Mm.
You know,
we get shivers just thinking about the possibility of that coming true. Film critic and historian Joseph McBride, he'll be coming to Kenosha as part of this great Orson Welles centennial celebration, and his specific participation will happen on Sunday, May 24th, with a screening of the great Orson Welles film, The Magnificent Ambersons. And we want to remind you that he is the author of several books about Orson Welles, including Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career. Joseph McBride, we have just scratched the surface, of course, but I'm so glad we could have this conversation about this intriguing filmmaker and about your relationship with him. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great being on the air with you, and I look forward to seeing everybody in Kenosha. I'm so glad Kenosha is doing a tribute to him and showing my favorite Welles film, The Magnificent Ambersons. It's going to be wonderful to be there.
The time is 8:46, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. And part two of today's Morning Show is coming up in just a moment. It's an exceptionally busy and exciting weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin, especially as far as the fine arts are concerned, with five different exciting events which we talked about this week on The Morning Show, which I want to remind you about in the next few minutes of The Morning Show, beginning with a concert tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Prairie School at 4050 Lighthouse Drive, a concert featuring six talented women called Libana, who sing and play music from all around the world. They are celebrating their 35th anniversary as an ensemble, and they are helping Prairie School celebrate its own 50th anniversary. If you would like more information about tonight's concert, you can call Prairie at 752-2597 or visit their website, prairieschool.com. Here is a taste of the wonderful music of Libana. The group Libana in concert tonight at Prairie School at 7:30 p.m. Tonight and tomorrow night are your last opportunities to experience the classic musical The Man of La Mancha at Carthage College in the Wartburg Auditorium. If you'd like more information about tickets, you can call the Theater Department box office at 551-6661. Here is the famous title song. And I go on the wild. The Man of La Mancha, tonight and tomorrow night at Carthage College in the Wartburg Auditorium. For a very different kind of musical, you can go to the University of Wisconsin Parkside for the first of 2 weekends' worth of performances of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, one of the most popular of recent musicals, done in Parkside's wonderful Black Box Theater. And the phone number for information is 595-2564.
Please spell syzygy.
S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. Syzygy?
We have a winner!
Thank you! Thank you! Thank you!
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, my parents keep on telling me just being here is winning, although I know it isn't so.
But it's a very nice, very, very nice,
very, very, very nice, very nice beginning.
Our winner here last year, Chip Tolentino, Myth Peretti, and our youngest competitor, Logan Schwartz and Grubinier.
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Game, I'll stand when they announce my name.
Leaf Coney Bear.
And try and keep from shaking.
A laugh, if shaking will not pass.
Cause it's a very big, very fraught, simple, but it's not. It's a very big undertaking.
The 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this weekend and the next. There's also a very exciting opera event going on this weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin. Soprano Angela Brown, who has sung leading roles all over the world, including at the Metropolitan Opera, is coming to town this weekend to present her one-woman program called Opera from a Sister's Point of View, a program designed to demystify opera, in which she sings some of the most beautiful of operatic arias, while also demonstrating her sassy and sizzling personality and wonderful sense of humor. The program is happening twice, Saturday afternoon at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in downtown Racine, 4 to 6, and Sunday afternoon at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, 5 to 6. And both of these presentations done under the auspices of our local public libraries. Here is a portion of one of the arias which will be on Ms. Brown's program, Pace, Pace Mio Dio, which comes from Verdi's La Forza del Destino. Soprano Angela Brown. If you would like information about ticket availability for this free program, you should call either the Racine or Kenosha Public Libraries. While we're talking about the library, we should make mention of the Kenosha Public Library's giant overstock book sale, which is occurring this weekend at the Southwest Library on Friday, 9 to 4, Saturday, 9 to 4, and Sunday, 9 to 3. The Southwest Library is located at 7979 38th Avenue on the south side of Kenosha. $4 for a brown paper bag full of books, $6 for a slightly larger book. Incredibly inexpensive prices. A great opportunity for you to stock up on some books for your own personal libraries at home. The final fine arts event we want to mention is the event which is also bringing to a close this 10th anniversary season for Fine Arts at First at First United Methodist Church on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. They have brought us a whole host of wonderful events over the last decade, and this current season finishes up in a very fun fashion with a program put together by Mike Goodbar called Benny Rides Again, The Music of Benny Goodman. As he has done on a couple of previous occasions, Mike Goodbar has assembled a sterling array of local musicians, including clarinetist Tim Bell and trumpeter Tommy Meredith, just to name two of them, who will be playing Sunday afternoon some of the best-known music of Benny Goodman. Here is a little sampling of Benny Goodman himself from his historic Carnegie Hall concert in 1938 in George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm. The great Benny Goodman and his band in action at the 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. And again, Benny Goodman, his great music will be featured Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in the season finale for Fine Arts at First. So there's no reason to be bored this weekend here in southeastern Wisconsin, and we have some very interesting morning shows coming up next week that I want to tell you about. On Monday, in part one of the program, I'll be speaking with Dennis Duchesne, who is president of the Kenosha Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. In part two of Monday's program, I'll welcome into the studio several members of the Citizen Wells Society. They are the steering committee overseeing the many special events occurring in Kenosha in honor of the 100th birthday of Orson Welles. The actual 100th birthday is Wednesday, the 6th of May. And on Wednesday, the 6th, I will be speaking with film historian and author Patrick McGilligan, who is coming to town on the 6th. And he has written a book which focuses in particular on the early part of Orson Welles' life, including his experiences growing up here in Kenosha. So that conversation will be on Wednesday. Backtracking to Tuesday, we'll preview the Milwaukee Florentines' upcoming production of Donizetti's beloved bel canto comedy, The Elixir of Love. Next Thursday will be Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht, and next Friday, several interviews, including one with astronaut Buzz Aldrin, who's just written a book called Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration. Buzz Aldrin, of course, was the second man to walk on the surface of the moon. Mostly sunny today, high of 67 degrees, a little cooler near the lake. Overnight low of 48. Sunny tomorrow as we warm to a high of 73, 76 for a high on Sunday, but a cloudy, rainy day on Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.